I'm Sam Roggeveen. I'm here with Ashley Townsend, co-author of a new Lowy Institute for International Policy report called Shifting Waters, China's New Passive Assertiveness in Asian Maritime Security. Ashley, welcome. You talk in this paper, your headline finding, I think we can call it, in this paper, is that China is taking fewer risks with its maritime behaviour in the South China Sea. Can you say a little bit more about that? What's the evidence for it?
Thanks, Sam. That's absolutely right. A few years ago, it was quite common to hear and read media reports about Chinese ships and aircraft using tactical aggression in the East and South China Seas. And by tactical aggression, I mean the use of dangerous maneuvers, for example, cutting in front of US warships when they move to do intelligence operations within China's EEZ, or very close intercepts between Chinese and Japanese aircraft, or Chinese and US aircraft, in and around the East China Sea, and more broadly in the region. And in the South China Sea, obviously, we've had a few key examples, again, a couple of years ago, of China using tactical aggression or the threat of the use of force to evict the Philippines from Scarborough Shoal, to set up a blockade around Second Thomas Shoal. So these sorts of things. We're not hearing about them anymore. We're hearing a lot about island building. We're hearing a lot about the creation of military zones of denial in the South China Sea. But we're not hearing a lot about China's tactical aggression. In fact, just this week, a US naval admiral went on the record, one of many, saying that China's behavior when US warships encountered them in the South China Sea and in maritime Asia in general has been professional, has been restrained. And part of that is because China's calculus has changed. China no longer thinks that using risk to cause a crisis or to play chicken with the adversaries, with its maritime adversaries, that is a good way to push ahead its interests.
Right, so that brings us to the second part of the equation. We have evidence then that China is being less assertive, taking fewer tactical risks. What are the implications of that? What does it actually mean for the security picture in the South China Sea?
Well, right there, China is being less tactically assertive, but it's certainly still being strategically assertive. It's still building islands. It's putting missiles on them. It's putting airstrips that can launch military aircraft right throughout the South China Sea on them, and so forth. The implications of all of this together are important. Firstly, maritime tensions are now being better managed, in part because of China's tactical restraint, but also in part because of the new confidence-building measures that China has signed up to. So this means that maritime tensions are being managed, but they're not being solved. The underlying drivers for Chinese and US or Chinese, Japanese, Southeast Asian ships to move into close proximity, into tense strategic environments, are still there. The disputes have not been solved. Another implication is really that China is using tactical stability, the lack of a likelihood of an escalation to conflict, to strengthen and consolidate its strategic position. Simply means this, if China can take the risk out of its expansion of strategic influence in the region, then it can expand more easily, and it can expand with a lower level of concern about what might happen. The last thing China wants is to fight an unintended confrontation. A third implication is that all of this is bad news for the US and its allies and partners. China is shifting, in a way, the burden of escalation to the other side, so to speak. Whereas China's use of tactical aggression before was sanctioned by the world, raised the stakes for Beijing, and in a sense, stakes that Beijing didn't want to take. With building islands, it's quite a non-confrontational act in a tactical sense. So other countries need to decide how they're going to respond to that. And that brings us to the fourth implication, which is China is trying to use the US response and the regional Asia-Pacific response that involves countries like Australia and Japan and Southeast Asians to launch a PR war on who is the riskiest of them all throughout maritime Asia. China's saying, we're abiding by confidence-building measures. We're not being risky at sea. But you're sending ships and aircraft to the region. You're militarizing the South China Sea. This is on you, what happens next.
It sounds like what you're describing here and in your paper is that China's behavior, its tactical behavior has changed, but that its overall strategic objective has been consistent from the beginning of this campaign in the South China Sea, let's call it. So what is that overall strategic objective?
Right. China hasn't publicly stated anywhere what its maritime objective is, but it seems to us that China is seeking to expand its maritime presence in the East and South China Sea. It's seeking to have an outsized ability to exert military power in the region, to coerce and cajole other countries, not through the direct use of force, but through administrative rules, new air defense identification zones, fishing bans, right throughout the East and South China Sea, to essentially exert its authority in this part of the world. It might be part of a larger and longer term bid to wrestle primacy away from the United States. We don't know that yet. It might be, and certainly appears to be in part, linked to Chinese domestic ideas about regaining its place in the world, about finding ways to actually finally wrestle back territories that were stolen from China throughout the 20th century. So playing into that nationalist rhetoric. We don't really know what the overall objective will be, but it certainly seems that China has put a lot of thought into expanding its strategic footprint.
Okay, so we've established what China's doing, its tactical actions, and we have some broad sense of its strategic objectives, even if we don't know exactly what they're doing. But given that Chinese aims seem to be contrary to those of most other countries in the region, and of course the regional great power, the United States, what does your paper propose as a counteraction to what China is doing?
Right. First, I think it's important here to note that there is a good news story in all of this. The fact that it's getting less likely that there will be an unintended clash between the US and China at sea, or between China and Japan or others, is a good thing. The fact that China is abiding by CBMs, like the Code for Unplanned Encounters at Sea, is also a good thing.
CBM, I should interrupt, is a confidence-building measure, which is essentially a joint initiative to reduce the chance of misunderstandings that might lead to conflict.
That's absolutely right. And US naval officers will tell you now that China is adhering to some of these new measures. So this is a good news story, and we need to ensure that we don't roll back that progress in our response. So we should continue to expand and strengthen these sorts of risk reduction guidelines throughout maritime Asia. In particular, we need to bring coast guards into the equation, as coast guards are now the sorts of ships that are far more likely to encounter others in the South China Sea in particular, but also in the East China Sea. But we also need to push back against China's growing strategic presence in a pragmatic and cautious way. Part of this, I think, is about shifting in the South China Sea to a deterrence framework. Instead of talking about a response to China's actions, we should be talking about deterring further militarization, in particular of the Spratly Islands, and also the establishment of a South China Sea air defense identification zone, which some believe is in store. Shifting to this deterrence framework would be more useful because instead of using freedom of navigation operations without a strategy behind them, we could privately communicate to China that the United States will undertake more frequent or more assertive freedom of navigation operations if and when China moves to militarize the islands, as a way of dissuading them to do so. Australia might also get involved here. We haven't yet undertaken our own dedicated FONOPs, as they're called, but we might consider doing them with the United States, again, as part of this deterrence package. I think another countermeasure that's important, especially in light of the upcoming tribunal between the Philippines and China ruling on many things in the South China Sea, including China's nine-dash line. I think it's important that we expand diplomatic and legal efforts to put pressure on China. There's evidence to suggest that global diplomatic pressure, including Australia's, is having an impact on China. There are more and more Chinese scholars and analysts that are talking about how they've lost the region, that are noting how China's overly assertive strategy is actually causing a counterbalancing in the region and strengthening US alliances and partnerships. So this diplomatic shaming, so to speak, seems to be working internally as well. And then finally, we might also consider indirect costs. Some indirect costs are already underway. That is the strengthening of US alliances and partnerships, the new basing access arrangements, for example, in the Philippines. But others might involve economic measures, complicating some of China's larger economic plans for the region, like the One Belt, One Road, Maritime Silk Road Initiative, or even sanctioning Chinese corporations that are involved in island building. Now, these things do risk a sort of a larger escalatory cycle, so we need to be cautious, and we should again use that deterrence framework. But we may need to push back in indirect ways, precisely because passive assertiveness means that we can't risk putting US and allied ships or aircraft into harm's way and then bring back that risk of an escalation.
One final question. You made mention of the upcoming decision by the International Tribunal in The Hague on the dispute between China and the Philippines. There's been media reporting, not well-sourced, but nonetheless media reporting, that if this decision comes down against China, as I think is likely to do, that China will respond by escalating its island-building campaign, particularly on Scarborough Shoal. So that tends to suggest that this passive assertiveness campaign that you've described will actually be reinforced in that scenario. So is that what you think might happen after this decision comes down? And longer term, is passive assertiveness a strategy that the Chinese will pursue for years to come?
Regarding the ruling itself and what's happening at the Scarborough Shoal, I think that it's certainly possible China would respond to a negative verdict, or indeed any verdict, by building, constructing facilities on Scarborough Shoal. It would have, in a sense, a greater significance perhaps than some of the other outposts that it's been building, because Scarborough Shoal was the one feature in the South China Sea essentially directly wrestled from the Philippines through Chinese gunboat diplomacy a few years ago. So the fact that that happened, that in a sense territorial change of hands happened through the threat of the use of force and through Chinese manipulation of the strategic and tactical picture there, means that there's a greater significance attached to what happens at Scarborough Shoal. And of course, the Philippines is a US ally, so whether the US preempts or responds to Chinese activities there by bringing directly Scarborough Shoal into the US-Philippine alliance commitment is something to watch. Conversely, I think that China is starting to worry about its reputational damage. It's already lining up diplomatic partners like Russia, Cambodia, Laos, and even Brunei in ways to support its version of events around the tribunal. The risk here is that for China, and the risk I think it's sensitive to, is that it might go too far by building on Scarborough Shoal. It's possible, I think that building on Scarborough Shoal after the trial would be viewed by the world as essentially an act of defiance against international law. And I don't think that's something that China would take lightly. I think it wants to complicate the legality of the verdict rather than directly oppose it. But of course, this would be an act of passive assertiveness if China were to build on that shoal now or after the verdict. I think that in terms of our response to the verdict, we need to be sensitive to the unfortunate reality that whether or not Beijing created it, the situation within China makes it impossible for Chinese leaders to come out and support the ruling now. China has backed themselves into a corner, but the US and its allies and partners need to be cautious not to back ourselves into a corner by saying, for example, that we will actively enforce that ruling. I think both sides need to move through this roadblock, and a sign that compromise or a way forward is in store would be if we start to see a process of negotiation or at least discussion about the nature of reefs, rocks and shoals in the South China Sea between claimants, including China, after the tribunal hands down its verdict, or indeed renewed or reinvigorated negotiation of a South China Sea code of conduct.
Ashley Townsend, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Sam.